Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
And now, another great moment in presidential history. America has seen its share of great presidents with historic accomplishments. But did you know that Barack Obama is so great? His name has been added to the biographies of 13 presidents. It's right there on his White House website.
I would put our legislative and foreign policy accomplishments in our first 2 years against any president, with the possible exceptions of Johnson, FDR, and Lincoln.
As for his Treasury Secretary, the greatest since Alexander Hamilton?
There has never been a Secretary of the Treasury, except maybe Alexander Hamilton, who's had to deal with the multiplicity of issues that Secretary Geithner's having to deal with.
And Obama's Vice President?
A three-letter word, jobs. J-O-B-S, jobs.
Not quite as great. America's fourth greatest president, second greatest Treasury Secretary, and 47th greatest Vice President. Together, only they could raise the debt limit to $16 trillion and keep 13 million Americans out of work. And how does the president grade himself on these accomplishments?
I won't give us a letter grade. I think it's still incomplete.
Well done, Mr. President. Well done.
If I don't have this done in 3 years, then there's going to be a one-term proposition.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that, ladies and gentlemen, a little bit of fun and games before a nice long Memorial Day weekend. I hope you will all relax and prepare yourselves for the rough ride and stormy seas ahead. Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the wake-up call. It is Friday, the 20th of May, and I am broadcasting to you from Singapore, and my name is Richard Martin. Well, next Monday will be, as you know, Memorial Day, and PRN will not be broadcasting live, but I did prevail upon our long-suffering engineer, Matt, to allow me to record a show for you, which I did yesterday. Now, it's connected to an appraisal of the Federal Reserve by Jim Grant, which he gave in a speech to members of the New York Fed earlier this year. And in it, he pulls absolutely no punches. It is, in my opinion, electrifying and full of interesting information. And I think you'll find it very, very interesting indeed. And I hope you will take the opportunity to listen to it on the beach or in the garden or wherever you may happen to be. You know, this organization is truly as evil as it gets. It has absolutely no interest in your well-being. It wasn't even set up to do so. And quite simply, it has to go. And I believe it will be gone within the next 5 years. It has done incalculable damage to the financial system. Indeed, even to the American way of life. And it's up to the likes of me to draw your attention to its horror and develop a public understanding of its pernicious support of the banks versus the people. You know, in capitalism, in a truly free market, the consumer decides what is being produced, how resources are allocated, and who makes profits and who doesn't. By buying from some and not buying from others, the consumer ultimately directs production, economic activity, and the use of scarce resources. Under capitalism, the consumer decides how capital is deployed. Our problem is that today we have no capitalism in finance, and the reason for this is quite simply the abandonment of a gold standard and the establishment in its place of a system of unlimited fiat money and of central banking. Gold and silver have been used as money in the form of coins for 2,500 years. Modern finance started with the rise of banking roughly 300 years ago. Banks have never really confined themselves to just taking deposits and making loans, but pretty much from the start, They've been in the business of creating money, a business that they invented. Of course, money proper was still gold or silver, and those could not be created by banks. But banks issued what I will call money derivatives. Think banknotes or bank deposits. As these were not gold or silver, they were not money proper. But they were usually claims on gold or silver, and they began to circulate in the economy and were used by the public as if they were money proper. And of course, if all money derivatives in circulation had been fully backed by gold or silver in the bank's vaults, that's to say by gold and silver that is not presently in circulation, then the supply of what the public uses as money would not have expanded and the banks would not have become money producers. But, as we all know, banks quickly managed to issue money derivatives that were not backed by gold or silver, or at least not fully backed by gold or silver. To the extent that the public accepted uncovered money derivatives as money, the banks had indeed a license to print money. And this allowed the banks to extend more loans and make more profits. But the operative words in what I've just said are to the extent that the public accepted. The consumer of finance, in particular the depositor, decided to what extent bankers could become money producers. If depositors became uncomfortable with the practices of their banker, they no longer accepted this money derivatives, but instead removed their deposits and placed them with somebody else, or simply held physical gold and silver again. The consumer had the power to pull the plug on the bankers. Under the gold standard, what was accepted as money was ultimately decided by the public. The license to print money could be revoked by the depositors at any time. That put the banker in a perilous position. Being a money creator was lucrative, but it placed the banker at the mercy of a fickle public. There was always the risk of a bank and panic and a bank run. That's why bankers before the introduction of the Federal Reserve in 1913 were conservative and extremely concerned with a public appearance of restraint, prudence, and the utmost reliability. After the bank panic of 1907, the sovereign consumer decided that there were now too many money derivatives around, and that he now preferred to hold money proper again, i.e. gold. It was apparently deemed okay for the consumer to shift from currency, i.e. gold, to deposits, thereby widening the definition of what was accepted as money and thus allowing the banks to create more of it. But, so the founders of the new Federal Reserve System decreed, it was not acceptable that the consumer would ever narrow the definition of money again and reduce the bank's ability to place more money derivatives. The state thus entered the scene in the form of the Federal Reserve in order to protect the banks from the changing preferences of the public, at least those changes in preference that were bound to limit money creation and credit expansion. There is no escaping the fact that the establishment of a central bank as a backstop for the bank's production of money derivatives was the starting point of a process of disenfranchisement of the depositor as ultimate controller and arbiter of what is money, of how much there should be of it, and of what makes good and prudent banks. The power of the depositor, the consumer of banking, was weakened, and the power of the central banker, the bureaucrat, as ultimate judge of what is money and what is good banking, was strengthened. The bond between banker and depositor was starting to be replaced with the bond between banker and central banker. It is clear that the interest of banker and bureaucrat were closely aligned, and both pointed towards ever more money production. The banker wanted to conduct the lucrative business of creating and placing money derivatives with the public without the risk of sudden changes in consumer preferences. The state officials wanted to encourage monetary expansion, as this was deemed to be good for business, and because the state itself was, of course, an important borrower. It is hardly surprising that with the advent of central banking and later unlimited fiat money, state borrowing began to expand. The money-induced credit boom of the 1920s ended in the crash of 1929, and although the public had accepted more money derivatives during the boom, as these now came with a government backstop from the young Federal Reserve, and this had made the extended boom possible in the first place, when the bust started, the consumer definitely wanted to hold money proper again, and that was still gold. Bank runs still ensued, and now were much worse than they ever had been in the pre-Fed era, simply because the Fed had by now encouraged the issuance of vastly more money derivatives. Although the country was officially on a gold standard, and the banks had promised their depositors repayment in gold as part of their strategy to place their money derivatives with the public, the state decreed that the banks would collectively default on this promise and that they could still continue as going concerns. The state also decreed that money derivatives were now the new money proper. And in order to leave the public no choice whatsoever and no say in what was money or not, the state confiscated all previous money proper, that is gold, via executive order of the president in 1933. In the United States of America, private ownership of gold remained severely restricted after that time until 1974. The money consumer had been disenfranchised. What bankers could do and not do, how much money there was in the economy, and what interests were to be, none of this was any longer a give and take between profit-seeking bankers and their banking consumers, and thus identical in its dynamics to the relationship between any entrepreneur and his customer. But it was now the outcome of policy. In 1953, the Chamber of Commerce of the United States published a pamphlet entitled The Mystery of Money that roundly stated, "Money is what the government says it is." The bankers, by and large, embraced this change. It was better to be in bed with the state than the fickle public. The state had unlimited resources, almost, and could make laws. And most important, the state was interested in constant monetary expansion, a magnificently lucrative proposition for the bankers as money derivative producers. And that's exactly where we stand today, my friends. Well, you will hear more about the infamous, odious Federal Reserve on Monday morning at 10 a.m. right here on PRN and the Wake Up Call. And so make it your job to listen, please. I think you will enjoy what you have to hear. All right, here's my information. I am Richard Martin. This is the Wake Up Call and the telephone toll-free to our little party here is 888-874-4888. Again, the toll-free number beckoning you at all times, not just on my show, but at every other show on PRN, is always the same. It is 888-874-4888. And the email address, which many of you have used in the past and will probably use again, is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD, which stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. .com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. And if you'd like to call me in private to discuss your own individual economic financial problems of one sort or another, you may feel free to do so by calling me at our Sarasota, Florida phone number, which is my direct line to Singapore, and it is area code 941-441-1682. Again, my direct number to be called at any time of the day or night, remembering to leave your name and a phone number if I'm not here. I am 12 hours ahead of you, so it really doesn't matter when you call. Call any time and be glad to take the call. 941-441-1682. All right, well, our next Richard Martin meetup group in New Brunswick, New Jersey is confirmed on Sunday, June the 24th at 2 p.m., always at the George Street Ale House, 378 George Street. And again, our moderator will be Jack, and his number is 914-414-6940. That's Jack Chavesta at 914-414-6940. And ladies and gentlemen, I may tell you that I am being almost inundated with emails from people and the most outrageous invasion of people's privacy as expressed usually by the police. And this has no geographical imperative. It is all over the country. The police are becoming absolutely out of control everywhere you look. I could just spend literally 20 minutes giving you story after story of things that have come my way via my trusted and faithful listeners. I can't do justice to it all, ladies and gentlemen. I just can't. I'll bring you some from time to time, but your country is becoming truly the Wild West nationwide. And you know what you have to do, ladies and gentlemen, and you will get some help, succor, information, and encouragement at the meetup groups. I urge you to go to them. They're in New Jersey, in New Brunswick. We had somebody come from a huge distance, like driving 7 hours to come to the last meetup group. So people do find a need for this. So I would be really pleased to see many of you coming and exchanging views and opinions. Jack will have things for you, hopefully. He'll have an interesting featured topic. And so please do try to make it on the 24th, Sunday the 24th of June. All right, well, as you know, ladies and gentlemen, one of my favorite people to bring to you in terms of clips is Nigel Farage. I do this because, as you know, every clip is of Farage talking to members of the European Parliament in official parliamentary session in the Parliament building. This is not just people talking to him, reporters on the radio or TV, and him sounding off. He is talking to the equivalent of your Congress. And I play these clips because I see absolutely no reason why people shouldn't be talking like this in Congress. And sad to report, I have to say, I cannot understand why Ron Paul or Rand Paul hasn't seen fit to talk along the terms that Farage talks in these clips. And just to give you a constant idea of what can be done in terms of informing other people, your colleagues in government or the public at large, I play you these clips. And Matt is now going to play you yet another one, and I will be right back.
We're in the midst of an economic and increasingly humanitarian crisis, and yet Commission President Barroso is not here. Indeed, Herman Van Rompuy is not here either. Not that it really matters, because they're not prepared to listen to any debate or any argument. They're intent on pursuing their political dream of a United States of Europe. They're prepared to commit economic suicide for an entire continent. And tomorrow night, Mr. Van Rompuy has called yet another summit, at which he's going to present a strategy for growth and jobs. Elected MEPs, representatives of the people of Europe, from left and right, we've heard it all before. Remember, the euro itself was supposed to create growth and jobs, and yet it is actively destroying both of those things. The remedy we're being offered is more of the same. I would suggest that the medicine is killing the patient, and to increase the dosage is madness. And don't listen to those who will tell you that the only alternative is for Greece to stay in the euro. Everyone's pushing this. David Cameron, all the other leaders are saying, we must keep Greece in the euro. If she leaves, the sky will fall in. It won't. There'll be a few difficult weeks, and then things will settle down. There'll be a boom in tourism. Investment will start to come back into Greece. Innovation will start to come back into Greece as people start making products to beat expensive imports. Indeed, Greece outside of the eurozone may well provide to be an inspiration for Spain, for Portugal, and many other countries. We need to recognise that a terrible mistake has been made. We must resolve to put it right. We've got to give people hope, because out there now is absolute despair. We all remember Dimitris Christoulis, the 77-year-old former pharmacist who shot himself dead outside the Greek Parliament. But he is just one of a growing humanitarian disaster. Huge increases in suicides in Italy, in Greece, particularly from people running small businesses who cannot see a way out of the problem. Children being left in increasing numbers outside the doors of churches because they can't afford to feed them. Our leaders are too callous to listen and care. You can do something about this. You can rise up and say, and I know in my conversations with you that many of you agree with me that I'm right. We've got to break up the euro. We've got to restore democracy. We've got to restore human dignity. We must ignore Messrs. Barroso and Van Rompuy. They have been proved to be wrong. We must provide people with hope.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not saying the problems are the same in the United States, far from it. There are problems which are pressing and urgent, but nobody is suggesting at this point the breakup of the United States of America. But, Europe was a false construct to begin with, and they just really don't get it in Europe, that there was no way in which this unification of cultures could possibly work. And I said it at the time, and I know a lot of other people did too, but Germany, interestingly enough, was between a rock and a hard place, because it really never wanted to join up with the rest of Europe. It knew perfectly well that its interests were not aligned with those of the Club Med countries, but it also knew that it had to look European after what had happened in 1914 and 1939. It simply couldn't afford to remain aloof. And therefore, with great sadness and great reluctance, it agreed to the concept of the European Union and then all of what that entailed, including a European currency. Well, I'm sure they're regretting it now, and they will continue to regret it. But The nonsense is just stunning. I mean, the mainstream media propaganda machine proclaims things like Europe must balance growth with austerity. And you see this in North America, you see it in Europe, you see it around the world. You know, these shameless practitioners in double talk are telling us that Europe is going to balance cutting spending with more spending. You know, officially all of the deadbeat debtors are still on their austerity diet. But now they have all collectively agreed to look the other way whenever one of these dieters decides to raid the refrigerator for a piece of cheesecake. In the case of the UK, this involves no change in direction at all, since the UK has been on stimulus all along. And while ordinary people in the UK have been punished with month after month of sadistic suicidal austerity, the Bank of England has been showering its bankers with new money, courtesy of more UK quantitative easing. Presumably, where this new money printing might differ from the UK's old one is that now some of the new spending might actually find its way into the hands of ordinary people. And then again, perhaps all this balancing growth with austerity rhetoric really means is that now all of European's government will start showering their bankers with more money while continuing to stomp on ordinary people with Milton Friedman's boot. The true verdict will come when we see the details of these new growth policies we're told are on the way for Europe. If what we see is just more of the UK's wild spending austerity, showering bankers with money while starving everyone else, this will doom the governments of Europe to the same fate as Greece, economies destroyed right down to their foundations. On the other hand, if this new balance simply involves injecting stimulus into the broader economy, then Europe will be precisely back where it started after the dust settled from the crash of 2008. Its nations will have gigantic structural deficits and absolutely no mathematical possibility of ever balancing their budgets. The difference, of course, is that these deadbeat debtors have now piled on 3 more years of gigantic deficits since they first announced their plans to begin austerity. As we see with the latest statistics, the crippling size of the interest payments to the bond parasites has now made economic growth impossible for Europe. Either way, the final verdict is clear. The governments of Europe now have no plan at all when it comes to ever restructuring their economies, even to the point of solvency, let alone anything remotely resembling prosperity. They are doing nothing but economically treading water until inevitable debt default takes place. The question then immediately becomes, if default is inevitable, then why not do it now instead of later? Any and every financial counselor will tell their clients that once bankruptcy has become inevitable, the smart thing to do is file immediately in order to minimize one's financial destruction. Though national economies are much larger, the principle of arithmetic is identical. Indeed, we have seen what happens when one of these deadbeat debtors delays bankruptcy as long as possible. Greece, by declaring its bankruptcy later rather than sooner, its economy is now in total ruin, and even after a 75% default on its national debt, more bond burning is on the way. Even the creditors don't benefit from delaying the inevitable. Oh, this is such a sad and unnecessary situation, ladies and gentlemen. Really, what this leads to, I really can't tell you at this point, but it could all have been avoided. All they had to do was to bite the bullet when it first happened, and both in the United States and in Europe and indeed Japan 20 years ago, this would all be over and we would be well on the way to recovery. As it is, we are now confined to years and years of misery because of the hubris and the arrogance of the politicians. And then you wonder why I don't do politics on this show. All right, let's take our break, and I'll be right back. And we are back. Well, this week, as I'm sure you are aware, the university stupid brainchild of U.S. Senators Chuck Schumer and Bob Casey, known as the Expatriate Act, inched a bit closer towards becoming law. Expatriate is an absurd acronym that stands for Expatriation Prevention by Abolishing Tax-Related Incentives for Offshore Tenancy. It's actually better, probably better to be known as the Tax Slave Act. And it proposes three key provisions. One, individuals who are deemed in the sole discretion of the U.S. government to have renounced U.S. citizenship in order to avoid U.S. taxes will be permanently barred from re-entering the United States. Can you believe that? Two, such individuals will also be required to pay a 30% capital gains tax to the United States government on all future investment gains derived from the U.S. Currently, non-citizens who do not reside in the U.S. pay no U.S. capital gains tax. Three, these proposals are retroactive, and if passed, would apply to anyone who renounced his or her citizenship within the last 10 years. During a Sunday interview with ABC News, House Speaker John Boehner threw his support behind the bill, certainly a big step towards its eventual passage. Okay, so here's a little history. Dart Container Corporation was founded in 1960 by William F. Dart, the man who first perfected the design of styrofoam. Dart Container is today a multi-billion-dollar family-owned company with thousands of employees and operations around the world. In the early 1990s, brothers Kenneth and Robert Dart, heirs to the family fortune, renounced their U.S. citizenship and became citizens of Belize and Ireland, and set up residency in the Cayman Islands. Around the same time, several other wealthy Americans renounced citizenship, including Carnival Cruise Line's founder Ted Arison, who obtained Israeli citizenship, Campbell Soup heir John Dorrance, Irish citizenship, and fund manager Mark Mobius, German citizenship. President Clinton was furious, and in 1996, he pushed Congress to pass a series of financial penalties for people who renounce citizenship. At the time, a renunciant had to continue filing U.S. tax returns for 10 years after renouncing. Effectively, though, this penalty was a tax on worldwide income, not an exit tax on assets. Fast forward to the mid-2000s, a time when the asset bubble was at its peak, the stock market was at its all-time high, and real estate prices kept going up. The Bush regime passed a series of changes to expatriation rules, dropping the income tax filing requirements in lieu of charging a one-time exit tax on assets. In this way, the government was able to derive a much larger payment up front based on total assets, rather than chasing around a former citizen for a piece of annual income. In the years since the exit tax on assets was established, two things have happened. One, the number of Americans renouncing U.S. citizenship has risen steadily from 235 people in 2008 to 1,780 last year, according to Schumer's office. Two, the asset bubble has burst, and assets are worth much less than just a few years ago. As such, the government isn't collecting as much revenue from the exit tax. My sense is that the government has been watching the number of expatriates rise over the years and simultaneously watching the value of the exit tax fall, and they've been looking for an excuse to make a sweeping, i.e. retroactive, change. Eduardo Saverin is the perfect excuse. The Facebook co-founder's recent renunciation of U.S. citizenship has become a rallying cry for politicians to go back in time and steal money from former citizens retroactively, plus establish a larger base for future tax revenues. This is a truly despicable thing to do, considering that these former citizens followed the appropriate rules at the time, paid the tax, and moved on with their lives. Now, Uncle Sam wants to go back in time to unilaterally change the deal and expect everyone to abide, even though they're not even citizens anymore. The arrogance is overwhelming. More importantly, this bill is also a major deterrent for people who are thinking about renouncing U.S. citizenship today. The passage of this law will undoubtedly cause many people who were considering expatriation to abandon the idea altogether, as the thought of being permanently barred from entry is too much to bear. It's truly extraordinary that the land of the free has deteriorated to the point that the government must now resort to threats, coercion, and intimidation in order to keep its most productive citizens inside. Yeah, isn't that just charming, ladies and gentlemen? Just what we all want. You know, it reminds me of, you know, a spoilt five-year-old at a party where everybody is trying to play with his toys and he's basically upset because he can't have them all to himself. And so he tells his friends, "You're not coming back into my home, now go away." You know, there is an element of immaturity and childishness which is impossible to ignore in so much of what America does to corral its citizens, and even apparently its his ex-citizens. All right, let's see what we have here. I get an email from somebody called Newsboy, or Newsbuoy, as I think you pronounce it, who writes in saying, "Did you watch Donald J. Gogel, president and chief executive officer at Clayton, Dubilier and Rice Inc., on Charlie Rose's program? If so, care to comment? I had to turn it off before reaching my pro-growth tolerance and started to feel like buying that used car." Well, Newsboy, I don't know what this is or who it is, but I haven't watched it. If you believe that this is something worthwhile, then, ladies and gentlemen, give it a whirl. Turn on Charlie Rose or the archives and come up with Newsboy. This Gogel person, who I, by the way, never heard of, but since it is my policy to read out all emails of all shapes and sizes, I hope I have done justice to just that. Well, Tony wrote in and said, "Hello. If even half of the information you are telling is correct, why isn't there tens of thousands, if not millions, of Americans listening to your show? Do you have an idea of how many people do listen to your show? I will pray it is not a low number. What if many people actually do hear your program and there is a mass amount of people ready to leave the country? Or have we been fooled so well by the government and media for this to never even be a possibility? Would that affect the economy or only make leaving the U.S. harder? Thank you, Tony." Tony, it's an interesting conundrum that you posit here, because I have given a lot of thought to whether the United States government in its wisdom could actually prevent people leaving, not because I think it could happen. Ladies and gentlemen, I do not believe there is the slightest iota of a chance that America could or even would try to make people leave the country. I mean, that is just so far removed from any consideration that I think is acceptable to Americans that I don't think it will happen. And I do also think that you will be allowed to take money with you when you leave. If you are a bona fide resident of of another country, it's difficult for me to imagine that the United States will try to prevent you taking your money with you. You have to remember that any act which the United States foists on people outside the country can most certainly be reciprocated by the similar acts done to foreigners living in the United States. So I don't think they want to do that. I can give you one case in point. There used to be freedom of movement between Brazil and the United States, and then suddenly America unilaterally decided to require visas from Brazilians entering the United States, for which they made Brazilians pay quite a high fee. I understand, of course, that with one thing and another, United States people could have required visas from Brazilians, but to charge a fee and a steep one at that, I thought at the time was unconscionable. So what the Brazilians basically did, they did, fair enough, we will do the same thing. We will require Americans to get visas to come to Brazil, and we will charge double whatever America charges us. And that still is in place today. Furthermore, Americans require Brazilians to present themselves at a consulate in order to procure their visas. So Brazilians require Americans to do the same thing. So it's a no-win situation for the United States. But America knows perfectly well that any act that it foists on to people outside the country will have its own reciprocal consequences. So I actually don't think that they will prevent you taking your money out. This is an important consideration for anybody who does want to leave the country, ladies and gentlemen, so do bear that in mind. I could be wrong, of course, but in my international experience of these things, I doubt that I would be wrong. I don't think it's necessary for you to renounce your citizenship unless you really want to. If you're living outside the United States, you have already a tax exemption of some $96,000. I think it is. I think it's $96,000 at the latest count. So you've got to make over $96,000 in your new country before the Fed will even take any tax from you at all. So unless you really are considering leaving for, indeed, for tax reasons, you know, and it appears that America will prevent you coming back into the United States if they decide that's why you renounce citizenship, which, of course, is absurd. It makes no sense whatsoever. But anyway, unless you really feel strongly or can show that you're not renouncing because of tax consequences, namely because you don't have much tax to pay anyway, then there's no hurry to renounce your citizenship. But you should, if possible, try to get a second passport. That's always a good idea and always something which people do recommend, and I don't have any problem with that. So there we go. All right. Let me say another quick word about housing as the deafening roars of the Pollyannas increase. You know, silent in all the bullishness about housing are comments about excess inventories, which are bound to continue to weigh on prices, particularly due to distressed sales, and which have obviously pressured new housing starts. Fears of shadow inventory from severely delinquent borrowers and foreclosed properties sitting on bank balance sheets are very troubling. The housing boom from 2000 saw in excess of 2.8 million homes built over and above the 20-year average, and that's through April 2012. However, the housing bust from mid-2007 has seen 3.2 million fewer homes built than the 20-year average would imply. Now, the Pollyannas would say that the housing market is undersupplied by 400,000 homes. Inventories, particularly shadow inventories, are my answer to them. Using the argument that lower new housing starts should have eaten up the excess from the housing boom, excess supply comes from lower household formation. With an abysmal job market, kids are moving back in with parents or not leaving home at all. People aren't getting married and are probably letting annoying roommates stick around. Housing completions have completely overwhelmed housing formation. Affordability and jobs are what is holding the shadow demand back. Housing affordability, by many metrics, has never been better. And some measures suggest that households have room for new debt service. But that's just one side of the coin. The housing affordability metrics assume that borrowers have access to adequate down payments and credit, while in reality, credit standards are very tight. And while debt service costs may be low compared to recent history, they're held back by low interest rates, not low levels, and consumers with worries about jobs and income growth are likely loath to add to debt levels. On the jobs front, no one is going to kick out a roommate or move out on their own if they can't cover the bills. And while employment has come down from its peak, it has fallen more from people leaving the workforce than those getting new jobs. Jobs are needed to pull shadow demand out of the woodwork and soak up excess inventory. If you argue that it is a problem with people wanting to rent instead of buy, remember that there is a landlord for every renter. And if you argue that no one wants the gutted and moldy houses that make up the shadow inventory, so much the better. It means more building activity. The argument here is that we're building up a supply-demand mismatch. Conventional wisdom says that it is an excess of supply, and at today's level of employment, that is right. So you see, in the end, it all comes down to jobs. Show me a real, honest, genuine reduction in unemployment, and I'll show you the beginning of a healthy housing market. Ain't gonna happen, unfortunately. Okay, well, let me read you something from Sarita. Now, as you know, Sarita is a long-time listener to the show. She was a visitor to the meetup group, and she made the decision to emigrate to Ecuador. And Sarita has been in her chosen venue of Cuenca in Ecuador for, I think, probably now 2 weeks. And she's been writing to me, and I thought I would write to you, read you rather, one of the letters, emails that she wrote to me. She has made a very successful transition. She couldn't be happier. Her daughter is with her temporarily, and she has this to say. This came in this week. Dear Richard, we do not have the internet set up yet, so have not been able to listen to you this week. The fellow that was supposed to have our internet working was scheduled for last Friday. He never showed up. And then the weekend arrived, which of course meant no one would come. Today, Monday, he still hasn't shown up, and now we are hoping that he does come Tuesday. However, if he should not come and shows up Wednesday, we're really okay with it. This is part of living in South America. There is no rush for anything. Your programs will be a treat when we get to listen to them on the archives. The truth of the matter is that in 2 weeks we have become totally disconnected from life in the USA. I keep repeating to myself that we left May the 1st, and today is May the 14th, and it feels as if I had left months ago. No one here speaks of Obama or anything related to the USA, so out of sight seems to produce the result out of mind. I have to share with you the fact that here people talk and share and are very alive and not spoiled. Earlier this morning at 6 a.m., my daughter Leanne woke me up with a need to go to the hospital immediately because she couldn't breathe. The altitude sickness was awful, and she felt as if she was going to faint, and of course I was most concerned since I had no idea where to take her to. However, we called the realtor who got us this apartment, a Norwegian fellow who speaks 7 languages and is a gem of a man. He told us to go to the Clinica Latina, and there we met a doctor who was unbelievably warm, gracious, reassuring, and knowledgeable about her condition. He ordered the blood test that was needed, did the cardiogram, and after almost 3 hours there, gave her the appropriate medications as well as a prescription post-dated for the next time she comes here in December. We have never met doctors like this in New York. In the afternoon, we went to our local grocery store, and while in one of the aisles looking at chocolates, a couple stopped us and began a conversation of how life had been for them these past 7 months since they left Orlando. They are learning Spanish and starting some businesses. I felt as if I had met the Richard Martin of the world of entrepreneurship in Cuenca. We became friends instantly, and in time, I am sure they will share just what it was that made them leave Orlando, where apparently they were doing very well. We stood in that aisle for 1 hour, and in fact, another gentleman who owns an ice cream shop came by, another expat, and we will be visiting his heladería, which is Spanish for ice cream shop, where he makes liquor ice cream flavors. Yesterday we met another couple at a vegetarian restaurant who have also come here to live. They lived in Vancouver and felt that it was becoming exactly like the USA and that Canada is going down that same path and they do not want to be part of it. The wife comes from Argentina and spoke of how awful it was 30 years ago there, and so they have come to Ecuador where life is good. They traveled to Colombia, an option they discarded. We were surprised to find people who are feeling this way about Vancouver. They agreed that it is a total different story for Quebec. They said that Harper, that's the ex-Prime Minister of Canada, had been molded for the past 30 years to fall in line and serve American interests. I'm realizing that there are many people who, though they may not have heard of the wake-up call, are most definitely awake. It is so refreshing to be meeting them. These are people who are full of enthusiasm to embrace something fresh in a new country where it is possible to live well and without the fears or violence that is affecting the USA. I've been thinking how countries are like people. The USA is more like a dysfunctional and decrepit old person. Brazil is like someone in their late 20s with all their new gadgets. And Ecuador seems to me like a teenager with so much promise, someone with a whole lifetime ahead of them who is just realizing his or her power, individually or worth, and saying, nothing scares me, I can do anything. We'll write again soon. Regards, Sarita. Well, Sarita, what can I say to anything so upbeat? I really do appreciate what you have to say, and please keep writing. Well, on the same kind of vibe, here's something from Simon Black, who writes from sovereignman.com, which I thought might be of interest. So, here goes. The flight from Bangkok to Singapore is a quick 2 hours south down the Malay Peninsula. And by the way, that is a trip which I shall be making in approximately 8 hours myself. Though it might as well be 2 years given their differences. Singapore and Thailand are about as distinct as Switzerland and India. It's yin and yang, order versus chaos, safety versus insanity. I spend a fair amount of time in both places and tend to get this question a lot. Which is better for living in? Which is better for basing a business? It's a tough question, but I'll try. Singapore, like Switzerland, is essentially perfect. Everything works. It's efficient, clean, and ridiculously safe. Crime rates in Singapore are incredibly low, and violent crime is almost unheard of. This is extraordinary for a place with so much ethnic diversity. The economy here is perennially strong. I've often written that Singapore is ablaze with opportunity for workers, professionals, entrepreneurs, and investors who are willing to trek across the Pacific. Best of all, the government runs a very flat, transparent operation. There's hardly anything you can't do online, and bureaucracy is minimal. Taxes are also extremely low, as Singapore is locked in a never-ending battle with Hong Kong over low-tax bragging rights. For almost all of the expats I know who live here, Singapore is the only place to be. It's great for families, finance professionals, and entrepreneurs who don't want to slog it out in the mud with UNICEF in some third-world country. On the other hand, Singapore could also be described as vapid or even sterile. I don't agree, but anyway, have at it, Simon. Nightlife is a bit dull, but nothing terribly exciting happens. People work, earn, and shop. Most of the key areas around town lack character and soul. It's a bit like New Las Vegas in that way. On an intellectual level, Singapore definitely ticks all the boxes. There are few other places on the planet, if any, which offer access to so many amazing opportunities, economic vibrance, social stability, and extremely high living standards. As a friend of mine told me this evening, I love it with all of my head. It's a rational choice. I usually tell people that Singapore makes a great home for your money. On a deeper emotional and up spiritual level, however, it may fail to resonate. For my personal taste, I need a bit more picante in my life. In this capacity, Bangkok is the polar opposite of Singapore. It's a freewheeling, in-your-place, super-corrupt Wild West. In many ways, Bangkok is like the Tangier of Asia, a place that attracts international arms dealers and beach-going tourists alike. Last night, while out with some friends, a relative newcomer to Thailand started asking a question, "Here in Bangkok, can you..." blah, blah, blah. "Yes," we interrupted. "In Thailand, the answer is always yes. Anything goes. The culture is also completely different. Despite Thailand's reputation for revolution and debauchery, locals are fundamentally peace-loving Buddhists. They're comfortable in their poverty and find happiness in simple pleasures. In Singapore, society tends to be dominated by money, making money, investing money, spending money. This entire country is practically designed to promote financial success above everything else. It's no coincidence they're among the wealthiest people on earth. To borrow from Warren Buffett, doing business in Thailand should come with a warning label. I tried it once a few years ago. It's not pretty. The business environment in Thailand is based on coercion, corruption, and deceit. In Singapore, it's all about the market. Bottom line? In Thailand, you're going to be in for a wild roller coaster ride, especially when the king finally kicks the bucket. You can expect months of turmoil as the royals, military, and politicians wrestle for control of the country. In Singapore, you can bet upon a very stable, comfortable future where prospects and other professional opportunities are bound to be plentiful. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, have a wonderful summer ahead. I'll be with you back on Monday and on Friday live. Take care. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.